There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Sentimental Garbage Christmas Spectacular. My name is Caroline and I gave her a hi-ya and a hi-ya and I kick her, sir. And it could be worth a fortune if it belonged to her. It's Ella Risbridger.
Hi, Caroline.
Now, I've just given a very jolly intro that implies it's going to be a uniformly jolly podcast, but it might not be.
I think we have to consider the possibility that this may be a tricky Christmas special. Fun and historical and...
But not completely historical.
No, historical and ahistorical.
Yes.
But also potentially distressing Christmas special. Yes. Which is fun. A fun energy for Christmas.
A fun energy. So if you're kind of a new-ish listener to the podcast, every year Ella comes on for the Christmas special. And we've like covered a host of sort of things that now we started with Mitford's was first.
Then Kids Books.
Kids Books. Then Little Women at one point.
We've done another one.
We've been... Oh, the Efron universe.
Oh, the whole Efron universe. That was a happy Christmas.
What it tends to be is like these big kind of unwieldy subjects that can go on forever. And that if we were to pick... Like, for example, we could do a like one episode on You Got Mail or one episode on When Harry Met Sally. But what's more interesting to me is like a big general conversation that feels like the thing is tangential to Christmas, but maybe not specifically Christmas, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And... Back in like every single year, we get to like December like 12th and we're like, fuck, what are we going to do for the Christmas special? We have no idea. And then we just hastily come up with something and it always feels like the perfect thing. And but this time you like text me in like July being like, I have the Christmas special for this year.
I have the Christmas special.
And it was Anastasia. Why?
The Princess Anastasia. But please do not repeat.
But please do not repeat.
I think, well, I mean, you have to go all the way back to... I've never been in a band, mm-hmm. as you know. Mm-hmm. And many years ago, Caroline and I were talking about the fact I've never been in a band because I really have very few musical talents or inclination to perform.
You have a lovely singing voice.
Thanks, Angel. And we made a little pretend band for ourselves called Brand Name Adhesives.
Brand Name Adhesives, yes.
This is the name of the band that Caroline and I will never be in. And... I remember talking with you then about how our first album would be called Justice for Anna Anderson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in our friendship, there have been certain points where I thought we will be best friends for the rest of our lives. And that was one of them. Mm-hmm. Realizing that you cared as much about Anna Anderson as I do.
Yes.
And Anna Anderson is one of the names of the woman who turned up kind of early to mid 20th century claiming to be the still alive, formerly believed murdered by Bolsheviks, youngest daughter of Tsar Nicholas of Russia, the last Tsar of Russia. And this woman turned up and was like, maybe I'm her. Who can say? Could be. Certainly seems like I'm her, but I'm not making any claims, but maybe I am. Also, I don't speak Russian. I kind of speak Russian. And, you know, during her lifetime, there was always this question. Is Anna Anderson really Anastasia? Did all the princesses die? And I have thought about this story for a long time. I think when you're a kid, you think about it because there is the Fox movie, which is the only not Disney, Disney princess. And she's wearing a big coat and she's got a little dog and she does adventures. Mm-hmm. And a great soundtrack.
And that feels like a very non-Christmas Christmas movie, just because it's very cold and very snowy and there's a lot of grandeur in it.
Snowy and gold.
Yeah.
The two elements of Christmas.
Snow and gold. Yeah.
So they made a movie about it in the 90s. What year was it, Carl?
1997.
97.
I was seven. You were five.
I was five. And it's not a Disney movie, but it feels like it's trying to be a Disney movie. It was Fox's attempt to make a Disney movie and they really succeeded because it has a fabulous soundtrack. And it has this princess, or is she a princess? Who can say she's a princess? And she is wearing a huge coat and she has her little dog. and she gets swept up in this plot to pretend she's the princess. But what if she really was the princess? And I think that's a very exciting story. And then you get a little older and you realise that it's true or not true, or it's based on a true story.
Based on a true story that is in itself an untrue story.
Exactly. And what I have always loved about this is the many layers of myth that are all wrapped up in this like snow and blood and gold package, which is a very fairy tale sensation. And I was never particularly into fairy tales as a kid. I think that as a kid, they felt very pat to me. And then, you know, we've all read Angela Carter. The retellings also then felt very pat very quickly. But Anastasia is the fairy tale I can't put down.
Yes. Yeah. Completely. I feel the same way in that, like, my love of Disney films as a kid was very much like, I loved Aladdin, I loved The Lion King, I loved Mulan, and like the Grimm's fairy tale reproductions were always like, oh, great songs, but kind of felt a little, I don't know, it just never attracted to me for reasons I don't even totally understand. And so for that reason, Anastasia was always my central princess. Like, I had two of the Barbie dolls, which is a big deal.
I was not allowed any Barbie dolls.
I had the Barbie doll that had her like original orphan outfit, and I also had the Barbie with the big yellow dress, big goldy dress with the sash. I also had the music box. it was an obsessive thing for me. My first like proper online screen name, which has followed me into my 30s now, was Kazaraline. So it's like Zaraline, basically, after the Tsars of Russia, because I became so obsessed with this myth. And it's interesting to me because like we're living in like 2023 was the year of the phrase, what's your Roman Empire? What is the, you know, period of history, or like just a little section, this curio, this interest that you cannot put down? Like, it's gotten to a point now in my life where like when I'm feeling a little drunk or a little stoned and a little sad and I'm in bed and I can't sleep, what I will do is look at colorized pictures of the Romanov sisters.
And this is why we're friends, because I also look at colorized pictures of the Romanovs, which I think has a lot to do with Anastasia the movie, but also like I have a general thing for Victoriana in general. Mm-hmm. I've always liked that bit of history. I don't like it, but I come back to it. Like, I circle it, and I don't really know what I'm looking for out of it. I find it very tricky and like gorgeous in the old fashioned sense of the word. Like, there's word, like there's a lot of depth in all the colours to look into. Victoria,
yeah,
that whole bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's where I was thinking about it first, is this idea of like all the royalty was cousins. And it, you know, as I've said many times, both on this podcast and elsewhere, my jam is very much fucked up family and huge house. All the money can't make them love each other, which is why I am interested in royalty, because what's more fucked up than royals?
Exactly. And I think what it's interesting, because this is our third episode, our third Christmas special about a fucked up family. So first we had the Mitfords, then we had the Little Women, and now we have the Romanovs. And I think, as you just said, I think people who are interested in studying royalty are often accused of romanticizing it. But I think, and maybe many people do, but I think what's more interesting is what you just said, is that every single family, no matter how famous or insignificant they are engaged in a practice of the public persona of the family versus the private persona of the family. And that has never more dramatic or more clear or more fun than a royal family, right?
What a smart and good thing to say.
Thanks!
But I think you're absolutely right. It's that sense of what goes on behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And the differences.
Today, what we're doing is, I'm like quietly and excitedly nervous about it. Because it's like, we're going to talk a little bit about the various movie iterations of this story. We're going to talk about the what really, quote unquote, happened. We're going to talk about Anna Anderson, but I think what we mostly want to knot up and tie together is like, this is a story that has now been in the culture for over 100 years. It won't die. There was a movie in 1956. There was another movie in the 80s, a TV movie. There was the cartoon. The cartoon has since been made into a Broadway musical. It will never go away, and it will always be women who are kind of fueling it. And basically, like, what do we, as we explore each iteration of both the truth and the lie, and also the lies within the truths within the lies, the sort of literal Russian nesting dolls of this story, I kind of want to get back to like, why do we love it so much? Why can't we let it die, you know?
I think we are obsessed generally with frauds and fakes and fake heiresses. I mean, what's Anna Delvey but Anastasia, you know?
Yeah.
You know, a fake German heiress who's walking around the city being like, I want this, I want that, I'll open this, and you should know who my parents are. Like, speaking with her kind of Russian-German accent and everyone being like, do you speak Russian? Her being like, absolutely, don't ask me to speak it. I can't. I won't do it for you. But I can, privately, because of my Russianness. And I think, generally as a culture, we love the idea of someone pretending to be a princess or pretending to be an heiress and getting found out. Mm-hmm. I think heiresses in general are fascinating. I know that you have read and I think recommended to me the Laura Thompson book on heiresses.
Mm, but fantastic, yeah.
I really kind of recommend this as kind of companion, I guess, companion reading.
Yeah.
Because we are obsessed with the idea of young women with money, young women who say they should have money. And I think that goes all the way back to kind of dowries and the worth of women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Anastasia story is probably the purest encapsulation of take me seriously. I am worth something. And it's a toy we can't put down.
And it's also this fascination with female scammers, right? And I think what's really interesting and what happened to Anna Anderson as she was like examined by various doctors and psychiatrists, and is she lying and is she not? And this has happened a couple of times with female fraudsters over the years, which is that like doctors not valuing female intellect enough to allow for like a big enough brain that would allow for all this information and all these schemes to be happening. Do you know what I mean? So I think at one point there was a doctor who examined Anna Anderson and is like, no one who's this fucked up could be this devious. Like this woman is like obviously traumatized. She obviously, you know, is finding it hard to like the dramatization of Anna Anderson has always been like, and this sort of like beautiful little vixen who's just like, I don't know who I am. But like the reality of the Anna Anderson person was that like she was quite unpleasant. She was like very maladaptive socially. She did fucked up things all the time in company. And people who examined her were like, no one this fucked up could also be this devious. And it's kind of this undervaluing of like female intellect at all. It's like, no, she's fucked up and devious.
Do you think that male scammers get the same?
I'm trying to think, who are the great like male scammers who aren't like, you know, the Lehman Brothers or whatever, you know, like, yeah. Well, no, what's interesting is like, I mean, I just read The Fraud by Zadie Smith.
Oh, I haven't read it yet. I'm saving it for Christmas.
So the Tichborne claimant was like a little bit earlier than this. And it was this man who just surfaced out of nowhere, having been to Australia. And he was like this random Cockney who had lived in Australia for a few years and who kind of arrived back in London saying, I am the heir to the Tichborne fortune, which was this like huge, huge fortune that the main heir was lost in a shipwreck. The mother had put out all these wanted posters, like reward for my son to be found. She never believed her son could possibly be dead. This rando shows up out of nowhere who like doesn't have any of the qualities of the aristocracy, can't speak French, which was his childhood language, all these things, but still manages to convince thousands of people and have like people raising money on his behalf, despite all of the evidence going to the contrary, that he was the heir to the Tichborne throne.
See, there's something you said there that I think is really interesting. I just want to pull up, which is the mother didn't want to, couldn't believe that her son could be dead,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a key element of all these kind of claimants and scammers. And scammers feels like such a harsh word for it, you know? I don't know. I think a huge part of the Anastasia myth, the legend, was hope. The idea that these beautiful princesses, all four of them, it was the first time we'd had sort of kind of widely disseminated pictures of a royal family like mm-hmm. that. Like, you know, certainly in the UK, there had been lots of photographs of the four princesses on their father's yacht when it came to the Isle of Wight. They were cousins of the British princesses. Their colour pictures had been, like, seen. There were pictures in the newspapers of these four.
And they were taken by their father.
Women.
Like, they're the famously weak last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, who was like, just liked hanging out with his kids and loved his German wife, who everyone thought was a spy. And was just like, here's my kids skiing. Here's my kids on a picnic day. Here's my kids visiting England. And was disseminating this photography. Apparently, the statistic is there was never as much photography of a royal family until Princess Diana. Like, and this is the dawn of photography. This is like the dawn of this kind of celebrity. If we think of the 20th century as being the century that is primarily about images and the distribution of images and how that changes people's brains and how they think about people and celebrity and society forever, this, their patient zero of like, what does it mean to go from having portraits of people where you mainly see like one, maybe three images of someone throughout their life, to having like dozens of photographs of these little girls growing
and
up.
And the immediacy of it, I think, yeah, as well. When you see a portrait, you know there's an intermediary between you and the famous person, you and the, yeah, royal. When you see a photograph, you could take that photograph. You could be, yeah, the person there. It's immediate. And so you have these four little girls who grow up into kind of, grow up, but they don't really grow up. As a child, I remember thinking they were so, some of them were so old when they died. And now I'm like, yeah, they were 20 to 21, 22. Yeah.
So it's Tatiana, Olga,
Tatiana, Maria and Anastasia.
And of course, Alexei, who's the sick little boy at the end.
Yes, everybody's, yeah, little sickly pet.
Yeah.
But I, as a child, was obsessed with Four Sisters, obviously, has come up a lot for me on this podcast. Mm-hmm. I talk about it like therapy. Four Sisters actually come up a lot for me on this podcast. But, you know, you do Little Women one year, you do Anastasia in the next year. Mm-hmm. It's going to come up that I'm the eldest of four sisters. Mm-hmm. And I love anything with four sisters. And I have always loved those Romanov sisters because they were the big pair and the little pair. And in my family, we are big two and little two. Mm-hmm. And they used to sign themselves Otma. Like, yeah, OTMA.
Yeah.
And just like as one name. And people knew about this at the time. This, yeah, was not...
Their likes and dislikes were known in like, they were characters in people's lives.
And it's a very modern way of looking at the royals, really.
Yeah.
In the same way now that, you know, the British royals release like cute little tidbits about their children's lives in a way.
Oh yeah, literally I saw on the Evening Standard yesterday, it's like the royal family have gone to a carol service and like here's like
little, here's the appropriate
Louis
pictures
drinking hot chocolate or whatever, you know, like it's,
yeah, just the right amount of personality,
yeah,
to make you think that you know them.
Yeah,
it's like every time they leak something that's like, and little George went to a playground where he's quite mischievous. And everyone's like, he is mischievous. Actually, I think they think he's the somber one. I can't remember. No, the little one is the mischievous one. But they've all, yes, got the personalities, which is what the Romanov kids had, right? Mm-hmm. Which was, and Anastasia was the cheeky one.
The cheeky prankster, the cheeky baby.
The cheeky baby, the mischievous one, the little one.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason that the Anastasia myth won't die is that people really wish that one of them had survived. Yeah. And I think part of that is, you know, it was a whole way of life. It was a whole way of life that was removed. And I think we can probably talk about that actually, in that, you know, when we, Caroline and I last weekend watched the 1956,
yes,
version of Anastasia, which is a bananas movie, really. I mean,
it's a very odd movie. And what's odd about it is, like, if you're somebody who's like, you know, not that interested in classic movies, it's like not something you need to see. You know, it's not like, oh my God, everyone run out. It's as good as Gone with the Wind. It's as good as like, It's a Wonderful Life. It's not. What it is like, it has a lot of beats of very famous, iconic movies that we had at the time, like My Fair Lady and The, yes, King of The King and I, and that kind of, it even has Yul Brynner, who was in The King and I. And it's like, let's try and force this incredibly sad story into the stencil of a Hollywood blockbuster, and it doesn't always work, and it's a weird movie to watch, but it's like the good bits are so good and the bad bits are so confusing, but it's like very affecting because it was made during a time where the question mark was still over Anna Anderson.
Yeah, it opens with this kind of scrolling credit that's like, the only person that can tell if these events are true, if her story is true or not, whether she's dead or alive, is Anna herself. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know, even though I know DNA testing means that we know for sure that Anna Anderson was not the missing Princess Anastasia, we know that there were four Romanov princesses found in the pit.
Yeah.
They tested them against Prince Philip, as a fun fact for listeners. Testing corpses against Prince Philip to see if they were cousins. Weird.
Fucking weird.
Fucking weird.
And that didn't happen until, like, the 2000s.
Yeah. And even though we know that's true, and also, it should really go without saying that I am not a great fan of czarist absolute monarchies.
As a rule, but aesthetically, you can't be beat.
Democracy's got a lot going for it, but it's not
as picturesque.
It's not picturesque.
It doesn't have as much jewel-encrusted eggs.
No, I know. Imagine if we were trying to do an episode about Tony Blair. I mean, I would. I would do an episode about the Blairs.
I mean, put it aside for another Christmas special. Sherry Blair.
That Christmas card. The Tony Blair and Sherry Blair Christmas card.
I've never seen it.
Oh, we'll look it up after.
Okay.
It's unsettling. Anyway, so I was talking about DNA evidence before I got on to the Blairs. Mm-hmm. And I think even when you know that, A, if Anastasia had survived, she would have been dead for a long time by now. Mm-hmm. It still makes you be like, oh, but what if? What if one princess survived?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that neither you or I were into fairy tales, but we're both into this very fairy tale story. Mm-hmm. You know, it is Cinderella. It's like, what if the shoe fits, you know? It's literally Cinderella. I mean, in this 1956 movie, they have a silhouette of what Anastasia's body would look like now if she had not been murdered 10 years previously, painted on a board.
Yes. So the story structure that we know from the cartoon was first sketched out in this 1956 movie. The cartoon takes an awful lot from this 1956 movie.
I think the operative word, though, is sketched. I mean,
yeah.
It looks like someone trying to draw. Even though the film was made first, it looks like someone trying to draw the movie from memory.
Yes. Yes. That's so true. That's very, yeah, it's very true.
Being like, yeah, and then if you just stand over there, and then I'm pretty sure that you walk by a river for a bit. I remember that from the cartoon. And then there's a lot of snow for sure. But then, oh, then there's a grandma. Can you be the grandma? It feels like people trying to act out the cartoon.
It's amazing to me that, like, clearly somebody from Don Bluth's team was like, or maybe Don Bluth himself was like, I've just watched this incredibly sad movie with Ingrid Bergman that's really complicated and very much about trauma. And it has a kind of a weird ending. What if it's a cartoon? What if it's a cartoon, really, with a talking bat and like some very like Freddie Mercury anthems from a half dead Rasputin? And then we said, yes, as a society, we were like, yeah, a whole generation of little girls are going to make their whole personality around this, including the ones sitting in this sound booth. But like, it's so caught up in that mystery of like, is she, isn't she? You have Ingrid Bergman like meeting these con men, one of them being Yul Brynner, at the beginning of the movie in, I think, Germany. She's about to kill herself, which is something that the real Anna Anderson tried to do several times. At this point, I want to say, for trigger warning purposes, this is a violent story. There's going to be many violent things and discussions of suicide and violence coming up. So maybe if that's not for you, tune out.
I think we'll try not to be too graphic about it.
Graphic, but this is the reality, you know? So that's where it opens. And this kind of idea of like the con man preying on the young loon is like very consistent throughout every story of Anastasia that we've retold. Why do you think that is?
I think because it gives us something to subvert, you know? Mm-hmm. You must start with the con man has all the power and this poor crazy lady has none. And then you have to realise it is the con man who is being conned. She fits exactly this silhouette of a teenager they have painted on.
Yeah, in the basement of a Russian club, they've painted on the walls a silhouette of a Russian teenager, which would be her measurements had she lived. Which, like, how the fuck would you know that?
I'm glad they cut that from the cartoon.
It's creepy.
But I think what we're really looking at is what happens if she's right and they're wrong. What happens if she knows more than they do? Mm-hmm. What happens if the con man is himself getting conned by a princess? In some ways, it's a female power fantasy, isn't it?
Mm.
Of being like, you feel helpless. A man comes in and tells you he knows what you have to do. And you realize, actually, I can beat him at his own game. I am the princess. I am the person with the power. And without me, he has nothing. And I think there's something very delicious in that.
Yes.
I mean, the way in the 1956 movie, Anna Anderson, I can't remember what they call her in the movie. It's not Anna Anderson.
They do at one point call her Anna Anderson, but yes. Yeah.
But this woman starts to remember things she couldn't possibly know. And the movie goes very hard on. Mm. I mean, it is her. You know, there's a part where one of her mother's ladies-in-waiting is saying, oh no, you could have learned these manners anywhere. Mm-hmm. And Anna says to her, I remember you, my mother hated when
The servants wore
lip stain.
Yeah.
And I used to tell on you and I thought it was funny. Mm-hmm. And the lady in waiting breaks down because, of course, who could have known? Who could have known that?
And that's the other thing of like, and it happens in the cartoon as well, where it's like, oh, Dimitri and Kelsey Grammer are like, John Cusack and Kelsey Grammer are schooling Meg Ryan on like, and here's where you were born and here's this and like, here's all the things that you, preferences that we know about. Because again, we're working with a time that there was so much information available. And then it's like, oh, then she suddenly comes out with these sudden recollections of like, that are all like sense memories of like smells and like private moments and things witnessed from the eyes of a child. Like every iteration goes hard on this. And it goes back again to this thing we talked about a minute ago, which is like, the romance of the royal family is that it's the every family blown up. It's like everyone knows certain public things about a family, but only the insiders know the private things about the family. Yeah. And how naked and strange it is when somebody who you've made up your mind isn't one of us turns out it is one of us, and you know all our intimacies and what do we do with this information.
I think that's it, isn't it? It's the thrill of also, it's being a kind of voyeur within your own life.
Oh.
In that, well, you know, the fake Anastasia or the wannabe Anastasia, the Anna Anderson, is both one of us in that she's a regular person who knows what we know about the royals, but she's also got these memories and she knows what it's like to be in there, to be inside. And I think that's very seductive as a feeling that you could be both inside and outside your own family.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, isn't that the tension? For me, I think that's, and I think maybe this is why it's a Christmas story. Is if you're an adult returning home at Christmas, you are both inside and outside the family circle.
Oh, very good tying up. We didn't think it was relevant to Christmas, but turns out it was all along.
El especial Navidad.
El especial Navidad. El garbage sentimental.
I can't speak Spanish.
Can't speak Spanish. I'm sorry, Spanish speakers.
I wish I spoke Russian, because then we could have said it in Russian. Mm. I don't speak any Russian. Yes, but I think this is part of it, right? Is this fantasy of being inside and outside the family at once and inside and outside privilege at once as well. Because the thing about the cartoon, I know we're hopping around here, but the cartoon mm-hmm. is very much like everyone can tell that the best costume that Anna has in the movie is her massive coat and her dog and her hat. Mm-hmm. She's not as cool when she's wearing her ball gown. And that's why she has to leave. You know, there's a real fantasy about rejecting.
Yeah.
About, I guess you start with a woman who's been rejected by society mm-hmm. in every telling of the Anastasia myth, and then you end with a woman who rejects society.
Yeah.
It's a power. It's all about power. It's always about power.
And it's this thing as well that, like, and maybe this is another reason why we keep coming back to Anastasia, and particularly women love this story, is that it is kind of a makeover story. And we love a makeover story.
It's a makeover story to an extent, but she does reject those yeah. kind of ball gown and she goes yeah. off into the night. In both versions. I mean, what I think the 1956 movie does very well, I hope it's 1956, if not...
It is. I have it written down here. It's 1956.
Great. Is the trauma of everybody to whom Anna Anderson is saying, I am Anastasia.
Yeah.
The actual damage you can do by being like, and this is your relative. You know... The grandmother in the 1956 movie is simply devastated. Mm-hmm. She won't see Anna Anderson because she says that she sees one all the time. She's always seeing them. Mm. And there's something very real about grief there, isn't there? The thing of being like, the kind of hope and the crushed hope of being like, what if you didn't die?
Yeah.
And I think the 1956 movie that I find very surreal is the fact that the Duke who was supposed to, who would have married Anastasia had she lived.
Yes.
Is then like, hello, my dead ex-fiancé. How lovely to see you again. And that's a weird moment. It's a weird part of this story that is so much remains part of the culture. Mm. That you're asking someone to come back from the dead in both a public and a private sense.
Yeah.
And the public want to believe it, but in private, it's a much weirder thing. You know, I think many listeners of your podcast will know that someone very close to both of us died quite a long time ago now. Mm-hmm. And I think I speak for both of us when I say how weirded out we would be if he came back.
Yeah.
It would be very trippy if someone turned up and was like, hello, I'm your dead ex-fiancé. I have returned. We pick up where we left off 10 years ago. And I think that's what the 56 movie does, and that's what the cartoon has necessarily to leave out. But I think it is there. I think you can feel in the cartoon this tension of, I was dead and I am alive.
Yeah. And the thing as well that this... And in a minute we should really get to like, and here's what really happened. And here's how the facts line up with the myths.
We haven't even talked about Rasputin.
So much of the kind of story, which is like, it's so fascinating to me that like a playwright in the 50s took this story that would have been all over like the news his whole life and been like, okay, I'm going to wrestle this into like a My Fair Lady Pygmalion type of shape. But also to, you know, to make sure that the lead character is likable, we're going to say like, oh no, she's going to reject all of it in the end because all she really cared about was her name and her family and having a sense of self. And the money means nothing to her because all she really wants is the man she loves, which is the con artist who thought she was fake all along and was like conspiring to trick a very old, sad lady into giving him many millions of rubles. But why don't we go back to who the real Anna Anderson was and how this all happened in the first place. So going back to the real story of history, this is not a history podcast. This is a myths and feelings podcast. But we're going to like get the sort of the broad story of the Romanovs and how and Anastasia and how this all began and ended. So Anastasia, as we just said, the youngest of four kids, born in 1901, is caught up during the Bolshevik Revolution. The Romanov family are kidnapped and taken to various different places around the Russian border. They eventually end up in Ekaterinburg after several years of the revolution, kind of the October Revolution, sparking off and, you know, demolishing this old way of life and replacing it with the communist regime. These kids are sort of kept alive because they'll probably be useful and it will probably be worse to kill them.
Because these are very, as we've discussed, very famous kids. These are very famous princesses. They've been kind of, the older ones have been helping in the war effort. The younger ones have been kind of very sweet.
Yeah.
And everyone knows who they are. And while the Tsarist regime is failing, I mean, for a lot of good reasons, there's still a sense that these children are connected to all the crowned heads of Europe.
Yeah.
They're probably politically worth something.
Yeah.
And they're there with their parents. They're being held with their parents in a variety of houses that get smaller and smaller and shabbier and further away from...
For years. For like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever thought that they were going to be executed. I really thought they were just going through a tough patch. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's really interesting about the Russian Revolution. I don't know enough about the French Revolution to know if it's the same, but there is this sense of trying to being like, well, we'll go abroad. Because if you think about Russia, particularly Russian society at that time, you know, I'm listening to Anna Karenina at the moment, which I really recommend as a Christmas listen. Maggie Gyllenhaal, it's fantastic.
Wow, I'm going to download it when I get out of here.
30 hours and it's just gossip and niceness. Mm. Not niceness, but like gossip and people being in love and people having affairs. But there's this moment where Levin, who's kind of the Tolstoy stand-in, I guess. I think. And he's listening to the woman he hopes will be his sister-in-law talking to her children in French, even though she is Russian and her children are Russian. Mm. And the little girl comes in and is like, mother, where's my spade? I need my little spade. And the mother says in French, I speak French, you must speak French too. Mm. And they have to like stumble through this conversation in French. And Levin is like, why would you bring your children up in such an artificial way? And Dolly's like, I've obviously thought this through 1,000 times. Mm. They have to speak French. And what becomes really clear is like the extent to which the Russian aristocracy at the time consider themselves to be European. Part of Europe. And that means being French and being English and speaking French and speaking English and speaking German and going to Germany and being incredibly like cosmopolitan, I guess. Feels like a very dated word, but maybe it's the one I mean. And the sense that these very connected children who are part of Europe, I think they all thought, like, well, we'll have to live in Paris for a little while. Okay.
Yeah, we'll go to Hungary, we'll go to Germany, you know.
Yeah, Copenhagen, which is where the grandmother ends up because of, she's a Danish princess.
And so this family are one day in 1918 executed very horribly in this house in Ekaterinburg. They're very famous. I think this is a detail that really captures the imaginations of incredibly macabre little girls.
Yeah, I would say skip 15 seconds ahead on your podcast player if you're
not into it.
Not into it.
Of the gems sewn into the gowns of the girls. Because again, they thought they were leaving. They thought they were going to go to Europe and they wanted to save. Their family was like, okay, we better have some stuff to trade if the aristocracy doesn't exist anymore. And so these jewels were sold into their outfits. The bullets bounced off them, which is something, a piece of lore that existed for so long and was one of the main things that like held up Anna Anderson of like, here's why I didn't die. Then, I'm sorry, this is very horrible. The soldiers bayoneted the girls and Alexei and their parents. They were then driven out to a remote spot in the forest and thrown into a pit. And that is horrifying. But this is all happening in a Russia that is beginning to be cut off from the rest of the world, where there is a complete information blackout, and where the rest of Europe, who has been seeing pictures of this family grow up alongside their own families for years, are in this thing of like, and I really do believe this, and I have experience of this, as do you, of like, when you don't get a grieving period, when you don't get a funeral, when you don't get to see a body, this is why heads of state are exhumed and put on, you know, like put on display. People need to know they're really gone, you know?
I think that's it. Yeah, I mean, after our person died, I know that because there was no funeral and no body, we spent a lot of time being like, yeah, but really?
Are you sure? Yeah.
Are you sure not just like in maybe on an archaeological dig somewhere or like traveling?
Archaeological dig was a big one for me.
Yeah, I remember. You were really like, I'm not sure, guys. I really feel potentially...
Recurring dreams of the archaeological dig. And I remember telling this to somebody recently and she went, oh, so a tomb. I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, spooktacular.
Spooktacular. And I really hope that anyone listening to this podcast never has the experience of having someone they love deeply and then never getting a proper grieving process. But there is a reason why funerals happen. There's a reason why they feel weird. There's a reason why we dread going to them. And there's a reason why they're never as bad as we think they are. Because we really need to do this.
We really need funerals.
Yeah.
And
the world needed a funeral for the Romanovs.
The world needed something that wasn't just... And it's finished. They're all dead. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Now
or they're not.
Regime.
There's an information blackout. We don't know. But presumably they're dead. We haven't heard a peep. Like, I just think the psychic effect of that is insane.
Yeah. And I think then when someone turns up 10 years later and says, don't worry, they're not all dead. There's me.
There's me. And the me in this case is a little woman who was born in 1896 called Franziska Szankowska. And she is someone who was born in East Prussia, who had an incredibly traumatic life, beginning with the sexual assault from her own father for years, then going on to her leaving Prussia for Germany, ending up at a munitions factory where on the line she, because she has blood poisoning from a recent abortion, drops a grenade, is very injured herself, and also killed another man.
It's a bleak life.
It's a fucking bleak life.
Should we make it into a cartoon for kids? Maybe with some songs and a talking bat?
And after this, she's like wandering around a Germany that's on the brink of World War I. She's going in and out of asylums. She refuses to tell people her name because she's had a fucking awful life. At one point, she is like, put next to somebody in a bed who is kind of like distantly aristocratic and is kind of on a mad one herself because she's in an asylum in Germany. And she's like, you're Tatiana, I know you're Tatiana. She never confirms nor denies the accusations that she is Tatiana, who is the oldest Romanov girl. But somehow, this person who's next to her in bed... Again, there are many podcasts you can listen to if you want to learn more about dates and names of this thing. I'm very much... This is friend of a friend, gossip retelling. Think of it that way. That person manages to get somebody who's tangentially related to the Romanovs to come in. That person says, "This is not Tatiana. Why have I wasted a day of my life?" At this point, Franziska says, "I never said I was Tatiana." And then somebody says, "Well, are you Olga?" And she says, "No." And then they say, "Are you Anastasia?" And then she sort of says nothing. It's a lot at the very beginning. It's a lot of assumptions based on things she is not saying. And because there are so many people who miss these girls, who knew these girls, and who want desperately to know that this way of life is not over, by virtue, they're like, she's cold reading them. She is like, they are telling her information and she is storing it because she's a clever, clever person.
And I think you cannot underestimate the desperation of the Russian aristocrats who have just survived, who are now scattered across Europe. They have no money. They are selling kind of jewels kind of in dribs and drabs that they've managed to smuggle out in kind of hems of coats and, you know, dog stomachs and all the rest of it. That's
a direct reference to the Eva Ibbotson book, A Countess Below Stairs.
Indeed.
Which, if you like the sort of Anastasia cartoon, you will friggin' love this book. We did an episode with Laura Wood.
It's a great book, and that is what I was thinking, yeah. Mm-hmm. But then I do think that thing of being in the Russian club in, I think it's Belsize Park, mm-hmm. where it's like, none of us have any money, but we're all counts and countesses, and they're all working as like, it's like the princess is working as a scullery maid, and Count is driving taxis or whatever.
Yeah, but we're all here preserving this way of life in this small little space.
Yeah, we're all spending every penny we earn on like a small tin of caviar, which is...
Yeah.
People love faded glamour. Anyway, but to those people, the idea like a princess, that would be... Oh, we would not be dead.
Yeah.
We would not be preserving something that was dead. We would be preserving something that was alive.
Yes.
And we would be doing this for a reason. You know... I think about this a lot because I think about like the French people who call themselves like, "I'm the rightful king of France." And it's like, man, okay.
All right.
I once worked for a French family who were very keen on their aristocratic roots, and they had like a huge family tree. And it was like, well, you were never one of the main ones or you would be dead. And so you get all these kind of dribs and drabs of people who are just like, I actually... Because people higher up than me died, I must maintain this title.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's something very, again, pathetic, but in the very Victorian sense of like, you feel pathos for, I feel a deep pathos for it, for these people just being like, no, I am a count. In a world that no longer exists, I have worth. And so they're setting up these kind of fake courts, essentially, these fake things of being like, we are the Russian aristocracy, even though we will never go back to Russia. The Russian people have ousted us.
Yeah.
We are now scattered all across Europe living on people's charity.
Yeah, a few of us have like property and jewels enough that we're maintaining a high standard of life.
But not as high.
Yeah. Another great movie, if you're interested in this, is the 1939 movie Ninotchka, starring Greta Garbo, which is one of my favourite rom-coms to ever exist. But it's very much about the white Russians still living in Europe and what the current Russians, the red Russians, feel like that they owe them. It's the most perfect rom-com ever. I think it's on a... It goes toe-to-toe with any fucking Nora Ephron. You would love it. Anyone who listens to this podcast would love it. It's on Amazon Prime.
Little advert for Garbo there. I've not heard of a little someone called Greta Garbo. But I think what is interesting is... The 1956 film, on which one assumes the 97 cartoon...
Has to be based on, because there are too many things that...
There's too many moments of weird commonality. I hope they write in and tell us, like... I hope they're listening to this podcast.
Hope Don Bluth is listening.
He might be, Caroline. You don't know. You're very famous now. Don Bluth. But that 1956 movie is based on a play. Mm-hmm. The script is from a play. And you can so tell. There's a lot of people going in and out through doors, coming in, coming out. And the interesting thing about a movie based on a play, when that movie is about kind of, it's like a film set with the script of a play about a man teaching a woman to say certain words and dressing her up and saying, you will act as this character. in this court that is also full of people pretending that this set is real. Mm-hmm. There's so many layers of reality and acting to it that maybe it kind of provides the necessary cushion for trauma. Maybe it gives us a safe space to think about trauma because there's so many layers of pretend between us and the pain.
This is the thing. It is, again, the Russian nesting dolls of pretense and pomp and ceremony thing, because it's like this person, but and by this, and it's at this point, the sort of the both the myth and the reality is true. This person who is claiming to be the Princess Anastasia, the Grand Duchess Anastasia, needs to convince all of us, the last remaining members of the Russian aristocracy, the White Russians, that she is real, so she can both fit into and lead our expat society, who are, as you said, representing this, like, have created this fake court, essentially, in other countries to sort of make themselves feel like there's still something to protect. And so it's like, they've created a fake world that has no relevancy anymore because they can't go back to Russia. They can't actually have their kingdom anymore. And so they're like, okay, are you... We've created a fake thing, but we think you're faker. You know? You're even faker than we are.
Yeah, there's something... There's a weird... It's not quite a devil's bargain, but it's like, you've got to pretend we're real and mm-hmm. we'll consider pretending that you're real. It's all very... There's lots of kind of private trades happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because when the fake Anastasia, or maybe the real Anastasia, fuck DNA. I want to believe.
Fuck DNA. DNA ruins everything.
It's a good story. Mm. Let it live. We need to believe in that. Like, fakes are going to keep happening. Fake heiresses will happen as long as there is no women and money. Yeah. Which actually, you know, makes me think about, like, people who turn up pretending to be missing kids. Mm-hmm. Like the Maddie McCann,
there was
the Polish
recently,
Maddie McCann
over
fake.
The summer, there was a fake Madeleine McCann who had arrived from nowhere, who was Polish. That was like immediately I thought, Anastasia, it's so strange.
To be the missing girl, the probably dead missing girl.
Yeah.
To be like, please love me.
Yeah.
There's a line in that 56 movie where it's like, the love you want belongs to one who is dead. And I think that the grandmother says it maybe.
Yeah.
And... It's like this, you know, she says, like, the love you want belongs to one who is dead. Wanting a dream doesn't make it true. Mm-hmm. Which is very brave of the grandmother, but she does not stick to that. Don't worry. She really quickly changes her mind on that front.
Yeah.
But I think there is something in it about it being about the money and the love, about the idea there's a store of money and love for these missing girls. And if you turn up, you will belong somewhere.
Yes.
And that's very, again, another very seductive idea is that if you don't feel loved enough, there is, like, it's actually quite simple. It's quite communist. It's like, to each according to his, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Like, this grandma's got a lot of love going spare.
Yeah.
This woman needs a lot of love from a grandma.
Together in Paris.
Together in Paris. And you say, like, who's it hurting except, I guess, quite a lot of people.
Because it is this thing of, like, the world needed closure and the world needed to believe that, like... And as well, if you think of, like, we're hurtling further into this very crazy 20th century that is full of, like, war machines, you know? And, like, new sort of societies and new classes and new ways of doing things and industrialization and, like, all these new scary concepts.
New media.
And we're pulling away from all these things. And, like, and I can imagine for many people, as with now, like, at a certain point, 100 years later, it's like, it feels too fast and too much for people.
There are bizarre parallels. And I think this is also what's interesting about a historical story that you want to keep retelling.
Yeah.
Is it forces you to see how little people change and how the world is constantly changing, but also we're just doing the same things over and over again. You know, the world is hurtling in it. You know, it's the 1920s. Russia is in total turmoil and has killed a whole bunch of people. And, you know, sometimes they say it's for a good cause, but other people are saying it's a very bad cause. And, you know, there is the world is full of destruction and death and lots of people are dead and lots of people have recently, you know, lost somebody. And there's all this new media. So we're seeing images and counting numbers and we're seeing news from all around the world in a way that we never had before. And people are processing all of this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And it's
the
same.
It's the same thing 100 years later. It's like, it's different because in the specificities of, and now we have little phones in our pockets that show us, like, you know, pictures of kittens next to pictures of children dying. And that is doing new things to our brain. But that, what was happening 100 years ago, that was doing new things to their brains.
Exactly. I mean, if you've never, if your knowledge of world politics prior to the Victorian period, prior to newspapers, prior to photographs, has been basically limited to what you hear from people you know.
Yeah.
And like, maybe sometimes one of them has been abroad.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly like, oh, for one penny, I can see a picture of the Russian princesses and I can read about what's happening in, you know, South Africa and I can know all these things. That is going to break your brain in the same way that now being like, oh, I see, this is my friend's new baby and this is a picture of someone, some total stranger's dog, and here are some maimed babies. And I guess we just keep looking at all of those and trying to formulate ways to speak. You can see why we are confused and you can see why they were confused and hungry for information, hungry for something that felt like hope. I
felt like hope, and it felt like, to these people, to the contemporary people of the early 20th century, that like maybe we're not living in a war machine. Maybe there is still a romantic world full of like princesses and courtly manners and big ball gowns that we can still struggle to protect, right?
I think so. And I think it's romantic, even if, I think, again, it's this fairy tale thing of, even if it goes against your personal politics, which I think, you know, at the time there was a lot of extreme politics in the 20s, in the after the First World War, there was a lot of extreme politics, and to the far left, to the far right, obviously.
We know how that turned out.
As anyone who has studied GCSE history will be able to tell you, the roots of the Second World War are firmly in the first. Sorry, we're just having some champagne because that's the Christmas special vibe. Even though
This is an incredibly serious but very satisfying Christmas special. Very intellectually satisfying Christmas special.
But I think, in some ways...
Cheers, babe, by the way.
Cheers, pal. Happy Christmas.
To the Princess Anastasia. But please do not repeat.
But I think, actually, in many ways, this is what made it a very interesting idea to me for a Christmas special. Mm-hmm. It's very juicy. It's very full of, like, glitter and gold. But it's also full of struggle and pain. And how do we process those big traumatic feelings? And I think, in some ways, that is what all our Christmas specials have been about. You think about Little Women and how the minute we scratched the surface of Little Women, it was very much like, oh, God, war, civil war, trauma, death, children dying. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Hummels are dead. Everybody's dead. Mm-hmm. We've all got no money. Beth's dead. Father could die at any time. Oh, and the cats have died. You know, and now I must marry this old, old man because my girlfriend Laurie doesn't, you know. But, you know, It's fun, but it's also pain. Mm-hmm. Nora Ephron, I mean, Sleepless in Seattle, a Christmas movie about stalking a widower.
Correct.
you know? And I think children's books, all of them,
are about death.
All good children's books are about death. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the Mitford sisters, which was our first Christmas special, is just like, what if you had a bunch of sisters and some were Nazis? What if some were good and some were bad, but everyone disagreed on which ones? Also, you had one brother who was dead.
Yeah.
Very Romanov.
Very Romanov.
I think we are very drawn to these stories that kind of deal with the essential human conflict of the world is very beautiful and also very terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think...
And how can we make stories that are big enough to hold all of it at once?
And, you know, like, Christmas, midwinter, whatever kind of happens, whatever you do at this time of year, it's always about being like, there is so much darkness. There is so much darkness. Where is the light?
Yeah. How many fairy lights can we put in our homes to distract ourselves from
at least one more string?
The fact that it's 3 o'clock and it's pitch dark.
Exactly. But like in the kind of Christian Christmas story, in like the third verse of every carol, it gets pretty bleak. Like, we three kings go so fast into sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying, locked in a stone cold tomb.
God, I have not been paying attention to that carol.
Oh, that's verse three. Myrrh is, yeah. Myrrh is mine.
I mean, even to make it a bit more contemporary, like Fairy Tale of New York, like one of the most beloved Christmas songs of all time and one of the bleakest.
Yeah, I think...
And to bring it back to where we are today, I could have been someone, well, so could anyone.
Well, so could anyone.
And that's what Anastasia is. It is kind of like, it's very much a rags to riches story about female lying.
Like, but I think that's actually interesting, isn't it? I could have been someone, well, so could anyone. That is the opposite of the royal system.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, Anastasia kind of props up this absolute autocracy, this monarchy, because, of course, it kind of feeds our fascination with the system. Mm-hmm. But in other ways, it undercuts it so severely because it's constantly being like, well, if you knew the inside secrets, would you be royal too? Mm. Could anyone be royal if they knew the right secrets? Like, what... It's the public and the private. It's like, what makes the royals royal? What makes the princess the princess? And there's almost nothing more destabilizing to the idea of an absolute monarchy than someone asking that question of like, well, why you?
Yeah.
You think you're someone. Well, so could anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, so could any. And I remember one of the wisest, most galaxy brain takes I heard during the Queen's death was...
Go on.
Was that this year or last year?
Last year. Don't
we? Last year. Okay. I was talking about like the insane pageantry kind of thing. And you said something to the effect of, there has to be insane pageantry because otherwise everyone would feel very foolish that they worshipped an old woman for 80 years.
I love doing this podcast with you because so often you're like, I heard a great thing the other year and it turns out to be me in the past being smarter than I am.
Yeah, but that thing of like, in order for royalty to keep existing, particularly in a world that is like so media literate that it's like, well, we understand now that like, this is not a world of Holbein portraiture where we're getting oil paintings of people we never see but who control us. We see a lot of them, and it's managing the balance of like pageantry. I basically live next door to God, and look, here's Prince Louis giving the finger to John Bon Jovi.
Yeah, but you know, you have to do the pageantry, especially when someone dies, because that's the time you most need the machine to kick in, the machine of fairy tale, the machine of belief. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people will be like, oh, okay. I guess the old lady is just dead like normal.
Yeah, because even the most monarchy friendly people in this country would still, if you polled them all the week the Queen died and asked them if they wanted the monarchy to continue, most of them would have been like, eh. You know what I mean?
And because the monarchy is a machine that has existed for thousands of years, I don't know. I was always a bit skeptical when people were like, it won't last after the Queen dies. It's like, they're really tenacious, these people.
Yeah.
They've survived worse than this. Fuck on. And as far as I can see, it simply has just rolled right on over. Mm-hmm. Like, a whole bunch of scandals. A whole bunch of everything. Always. That's what the royals do. Scandal. They've always done it. They cling on. They're very sticky people.
They're very sticky people.
People who have power love to hold on to it. And I think that you need those big stories to keep them going. But also the Anastasia story kind of lets us have our cake and eat it. It gives us the pageantry, it gives us the gold, it gives us the glitter, but it also gives us the thing of being like, well, who said you could be in anyway? What if this crazy street rat emerges from nowhere and knows all your secrets?
So to continue with Anna Anderson where we left off, she convinces an ever-amounting supply of White Russians that she, and people who are friendly to the White Russians, that she is Anastasia, and she collects more information because, and what seems to be the pattern of behavior is that she will kind of fall under somebody's kind of care for a while. She will stay in their awesome house. She will go through their libraries and through their photo albums and collect as much information as possible. She will be incredibly rude to everyone until she is either A, alienates them so much they ask her to leave, or B, she makes enough slips that it becomes very clear that she is a fraudster. And there's a couple of instances which are dramatized a lot in both movies of like, here's somebody who worked at the royal court and like, she's here to see you. And there are instances of her convincing them and there are instances of people being like, absolutely get fucked. This person is a rando. Which again, very compelling. But what I find very interesting, and this is actually covered really well in the C Word podcast hosted by Alyssa Bennett and Leah Dunham, which I really recommend to anybody. It's on Luminary. Is like, did she know she was lying?
Intriguing.
So this is somebody who is raped by their father, who is then has an illegal abortion, gets blood poisoning, is put in a munitions factory, drops a grenade on somebody, at a certain point works at a prisoner of war camp like farming asparagus. That's just a chapter. Is beaten and raped by people there also. Like, it is trauma on trauma on trauma. Trauma that, like, physically and mentally probably wasn't that dissimilar to the real Anastasia's. Do you know what I mean? In terms of completely unstable, like, complete violence. And so she
becomes... I think also violence from people you formerly trusted as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the question is...
Did all of this compound to a person that is so brittle and so traumatized that when she was fed enough information, she was clever enough to be like, part of her like human need to survive was like, yes, and to me being Anastasia. And at what point did that just take over and become her believing it herself?
I think people have quite different relationships with reality. And I say this as a person who has an incredibly... fragile relationship with reality.
Go on.
Well, I'm very easy to trick. I'm very gullible, but not enough. I'm not very fun to trick because if someone tells me something is untrue, I'll be like, oh, yeah, I guess I just remembered it wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, I quite often, you know, I think it's why I write books, is because I'm just like, you know, I think memoirists need to have quite a flimsy relationship with reality because otherwise you would spend your whole life being like, what was the exact truth? Mm-hmm. Which is impossible. Like, if you write memoir, you're writing fiction. You're writing self-insert fan fiction about your own life. I really believe it. Mm. And if enough people told me I was the Princess Anastasia and that I had invented my whole previous life, I'd probably be like, oh, fuck, did I?
Yeah.
Am I? I mean, these people seem like they know what they're talking about.
Yeah. That time where that guy died next to me, maybe that was my dad?
Maybe. Maybe that was my dad and I've just put it into a munitions factory because that's easier for me to cope with.
Yeah.
But, like, I know people who have a very strong grasp on reality who would absolutely be like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. But I know for myself that if enough powerful people told me something, I would probably be like, oh, wow. Well, okay.
And if it was also to your complete advantage and your, like, further to your survival and having a nice life was to you... agreeing to this.
Yeah.
And helping it along at every juncture that you could.
I can see that. I can see why you'd go through the photo albums to be like, was this me?
And to her, she thinks she's jogging her memories, but actually she's creating memories.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know how easy it is to put a false memory in someone's head?
Unbelievably easy.
You know, people remember stuff that didn't happen constantly. It's like that thing of the bystander effect, like if you ask the witness effect, sorry. So if you ask like 10 people what just happened, they will all tell you something slightly different, and often those stories will be completely contradictory. Your memory is not good.
No, your memory is a Wikipedia page and it can be edited by anybody.
Memory is fallible, and I believe that if you do enough trauma to a person, their memory is exceptionally fallible.
Mm.
You know, there's literally studies been done about PTSD and how it completely fucks your long and short-term memories.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally, I mean, I'm going to get this wrong. There are lots of books about this. You know, you've probably read The Body Keeps the Score if you're listening to this podcast. But studies that show that when you're asking people to remember an event that gave them PTSD,
mm-hmm.
that memory is totally misfiled.
Like, misfiled?
Yeah. I mean, someone once explained it to me, like, when you sleep, all of your memories get, like, from the day, get roughly organised into, like, a huge filing cabinet.
That's nice to think about.
I know, isn't it? And when something is PTSD, it is misfiled. It doesn't get put into long-term storage in the filing cabinet. It's always, like, on top of the filing cabinet or, like, jammed in whatever else you want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It's, like, jammed in with a bunch of different other sensations and stuff. It's never, like, neatly filed away.
Yeah.
So you get nightmares because your brain's like, ah, not in the right place. I have to process this again. And then you get flashbacks because you're like, I don't know, you hear a smoke alarm going off and you're like, ah, that's an intensive care alarm.
Okay.
And you're like, your brain can't reach for like smoke alarm and be like, I know what this is. I guess I better get on a chair and hit it with a broom and like fan the hob. You're just like panic, 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 because mm-hmm. your brain is reaching for smoke alarm and instead is getting ICU alarm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, is it too much of a stretch to think that Anna Anderson was like, loud sound, pain, trauma, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Does it take away from her cleverness, though? Are we doing her a disservice to say, maybe she just really thought she was a princess?
It's interesting because if you, in sort of new work that covers her very early life, it's always about how she's this kid. She's growing up in like a very peasanty atmosphere in East Prussia. She's a reader. She's always hiding places and she's reading. And like, because she's like being abused by her father, there's also this kind of grooming relationship going on that's like, she's too special and too clever to do any of the work the rest of my children are doing. So I'm going to give her these advantages while also assaulting and abusing her. Which is obviously, you know, tale as old as time in terms of how child abuse works, of like elevating the child and isolating the child by telling them that they're incredibly special and also creating a prison of their own specialness so that they can't talk to anybody about what's happening to them because they're so isolated. And so we know this is an incredibly bright person.
It's interesting, isn't it? In and out of the family at the same time.
Yes, yes.
You know, she's suffering as a child. She's being abused as a child. And she's also being removed through that process of grooming from the family. She's in, she's out. It's like Anna Anderson.
Yeah.
It's
yes,
the public and
yes.
the private. She's kind of having to learn to do both at once, to be both, you know, to be both the child of her parents and the victim of her parent.
Yes. And by the time her father dies, she's basically run out of town by her own mother, who then remarries quickly and is never kind of, never really bothers with her again. And the next time she has any relationship with her blood family is many years later, when she's at this point living in America, because every aristocrat in Europe has both housed her and been completely fucking fed up with her shit. She's then moves on to America and becomes an industry there. You know, there are songs written about her. Ingrid Bergman pays her for the rights to her life. It's the first bit of her own money she's ever had. She gets married to like a local historian, genealogist, rich guy.
I do feel like that's very compelling.
Yeah.
Her life story rights were the first bit of it. Like, the first bit of money she had came from selling her life.
Yeah, her own money came from co-opting the life of another person.
Yeah, but also Ingrid Bergman's co-opting hers. And it is very fascinating to me, as I think particularly as a person who writes memoir,
mm-hmm.
and a person who writes kind of historical fiction in some ways, this sense of life rights. Mm. And whose life rights are you selling? You know, we have been trying to figure out film and TV stuff for Midnight Chicken for
years.
Literally years since it came out. And one of the key sticking points is always, whose stories are these?
Mm-hmm.
Whose rights have to be signed away? Whose stories are we telling? And like the words life rights come up a lot. And I find that very fascinating. It's like now handing over someone else to tell your story. It's another layer of them. It's another Russian doll, isn't it? Inside mm-hmm. this thing of, now you sell me your life rights so we can make a play, so we can make a movie about how you pretended to be someone to a court of people for a country that con men who are hoping to pretend to you that they're good people so that they can dress you up. You know, there's that bit where Yul Brynner essentially demonstrates his total power. He's like, if you don't do this correctly, I'll make you into a cigarette girl in one of my clubs. And it's like, oh, I could dress you up as anything.
Yeah.
It's just layers of dollies.
Yeah.
Dolls on dolls on dolls on life rights, on movie rights, on play rights, on, you know.
On a fabricated story.
About.
Yeah.
And also, maybe this is a step too far, but I'm going to go with it. It is, after all, Christmas. there is an argument, I think, for the entire world of the Russian court, as it was in Russia pre-war, being a fabrication. It was this kind of portrayed as this like very civilized, very sophisticated, very cosmopolitan place where, you know, everyone read and everyone went to the opera and everyone loved culture and everyone like...
And the ballet.
The ballet, and also kind of thought about like the feudal relationship mm-hmm. is itself a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. The idea that like the peasants love their master and they love to work with him.
They are good and fair.
They are good and simple people and the master is good and fair. And
that know, being a total lie.
A total lie of being like, I don't know, maybe this is because I'm listening to Anna Karenina, but there's a lot about like Levin being like the humble simplicity of the peasant, the mm-hmm. honest and mm-hmm. decent life of the peasant. And it's like, oh man, so many of them are dead. Like
yeah.
the life expectancy is so brutal and short. And this whole sense of a gracious court is built on this very rotten underpinning, mm-hmm. which inevitably leads to its downfall. And I do think that that layer of falsity, that kind of essential duplicitousness of an absolute monarchy on a kind of working on a peasant feudal base is the lie that leads to all these other lies. The whole thing yeah. is pretend.
Yeah. And what's so sort of fascinating is that like on one end of this scale, we have the real teenage girl who was murdered in a random house outside of Russia or on the edges of Russia. And then on the other, we have this person who, while not being Russian herself, is a victim of a society that crushes people, you know?
Yeah.
She is under the fucking boot of history and society of like, you were an abused farm girl and then you who tried to have a kind of a shot at an urban life like ended up in a factory explosion that almost killed you. Like, this is somebody who is very much a victim of the kind of world the Romanovs were trying to preserve, which is where poor people don't matter and can be written off anytime you want.
Yeah. You know, these are the idyllic honest lives of the farm people.
Yeah.
And I just think that's interesting. I think it's just this. It's like an M.T. Escher painting, you know, it like just goes round and round and round in a loop. Like you think you're going up the stairs and in fact you're going down the stairs.
Yeah.
It's just like, what is real? What is truth? And I wonder why, to come back to the question we mentioned right at the start, that is one reason we are so obsessed with it.
Mm.
It's because it really gets down to the essential nature of like, what is real
mm-hmm.
and what is fair?
Mm.
Like, what is power? Who gets to have it? Who gets to wield it? How
yeah.
do they wield it? Who gets crushed by it? And I think those questions, if you think about little kids, if someone does an impression of a kid, they will almost always go to it's not fair.
Yeah.
Little kids are obsessed with fairness.
And obsessed with lying.
Fairness and lying and power
mm-hmm.
and trying to wield those things.
Mm.
And, you know, is it too much of a stretch to say that that's what people do? Like, we tell stories, we make stuff up, we lie
mm-hmm.
in attempts, essentially, to wield power. And this is one of those rare stories which is not a fairy tale. So it can kind of grow with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start off being like, you know, dancing bears and
painted wings,
little music box and nice princesses in their pretty dresses, and everyone gets restored to the throne. And then you can move on to, oh wow, it's real, there were four sisters.
Yeah, and a boy.
No one cares about the boy, except for the Russians, who cared about the boy...
Very much more.
You know what, that's something kind of fascinating, isn't it? Is that, like, the boy is hemophiliac,
mm-hmm.
and that's a thing that's, like, carried in the blood.
Mm.
And this is all about, like, royal blood and tainted blood and who gets to be royal.
Mm.
And the DNA evidence tested against Prince Philip is very much like, no, but did they have royalty in the bones? Like, you, Prince Philip, you've got royal blood. When you think about what that blood has actually meant through history,
yeah, it means
not good.
Sickness, disease, weakness, you know?
Sickness, disease, weakness, and, you know, getting bayoneted to death in a weird house in your Katrinburg.
Mm.
I don't know.
But then it's this thing of, like, it's this interesting riff then when we get the you know, Francisca / Anderson / Anastasia story of, like, burning your credibility over the space of about a decade in Europe because you are basically burning out the dynamite string on how much people still care about this.
Mm-hmm.
And the more time that passes, the more people move on, the more we have new concerns, the less compelling she is as a person to sponsor. But we're now getting to the point where we're in the late 20s and she's like, okay, the aristocracy are no longer a concern for me. What is a concern for me is selling my story to Americans. And so it's like this weird shift of, like, now we're deep in the 20th century. Now people are going to the movies. It's not just about, like, seeing photographs anymore for a penny. It's like people are going to the movies. There are, like, silent movies being made already about this. What was it called again? The Woman Makes the Clothes? Or The Clothes Make the Woman?
Clothes Maketh the Woman.
Clothes Maketh the Woman, which is, like, the first cinematic impression of this story. So she moves over there and she starts becoming, like, a celebrity over there. There are songs written about her. It's sort of this thing of, like, the depending on the endless appetite for Americans for the kind of cultural seat that is Europe, of, like, that's where they have royalty, even though most of it doesn't exist anymore. It's why we still have a million Christmas movies that are about, like, lost princesses of made up European nations every Christmas.
Belgravia.
Just talented bakers finding out that they have an identical twin sister who is the princess of Belgravia.
But, you know, like, a lot of royals go to America. A lot of royals who are not going to be king or queen of a European country move to America. I mean, obviously Prince Harry is the obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Harry, who I think in the UK was always kind of seen as, like, cheeky chappy. He says a naughty thing. Mm-hmm. He's not serious. He's the fun guy. And, like, much of what he appears to be doing in America is being like, actually, I'm a real prince.
I'm a philanthropist?
I'm a philanthropist and a real guy. You know what I mean? But in America, that's not important because he's being a British royal. And I think the same is true of some of the Swedish royals.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. There's certainly one of the Scandi royals is married to, like, a faith healer, and they live in America doing, like, faith healing workshops.
Right.
Out of just, like, royalness. I mean, let us not forget Meg Cabot.
Like, Princess Diaries.
The Princess Diaries. And a vastly successful book series, which I believe is still ongoing-ish.
Yeah.
About finding out that you're the princess of a European country. There is a hold there. There's a market there.
Do you think Anastasia is the reason we have all these stories? The reason that we have the Princess Diaries and the reason why every Christmas there is 10 more Hallmark movies about a talented baker who finds out she's identical with the princess of a European nation?
It's interesting, isn't it? Is Anastasia the cause, or is she just the first symptom? Is she patient zero of this phenomenon? Although she's not patient zero, is she? Because of course we have this kind of happening, this kind of claimant, this kind of mm-hmm. I'm a European beauty
mm-hmm.
happening. I wonder whether, I think it's more likely to be patient zero. I think the reason we're still interested in Anastasia, who, like, let's be clear, this story was debunked.
Mm-hmm.
Even at the time this story was, had a lot of people being like, no, yeah. I don't think so.
And still, there are people who are passionate about how Francesca was the real Anastasia.
Justice for Anna Anderson.
Justice for Anna Anderson. Let her have it. Let her keep it. She worked hard enough.
She did. I mean,
she worked really hard, and she was psychically alone with this, you know?
But also, this is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets power? Why do they have it? Who lets them keep it? These are the big questions you should always ask when you run up against anyone with power, is like, who gave you this power?
Yeah.
How are you using it? Who are you using it against? Who are you using it for? And it's like, how did Anna Anderson get any measure of cultural power at all as a, like, an abused, you know, exploded farm girl from Poland?
Exploded farm girl from Poland.
How she got power was by using her trauma in clever and interesting and thoughtful ways to con love out of people. Love and somewhere to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I do find it hard to condemn her. I think there will always be part of me that wishes that we had just let her be the Princess Anastasia.
I know. Because then what really happened was that she married this guy who was deeply passionate to about restoring her to the Romanov throne. He seemed like a great little guy. I can't remember his name, but I saw an interview. And then I think she outlived him. She ended up living alone as a hoarder who, among physical objects, she also hoarded pets, particularly cats. Which is like, no, come on, Anne Anderson, you're more than a cat lady. But she, you know, the last kind of like mark of her in the world was the police report her neighbors filed about her dozens and dozens of cats that had to be, you know, exterminated. And that I find that really striking, in that like this is somebody who their life was so inconsistent that the psychological need to hoard people and things and creatures around her just to stabilize her in the world was how she died, you know?
Yeah, just to kind of mass up that weight around you.
Yes, like almost like pin you to the ground,
just
you know?
Like, I'm still here, I exist.
Yeah.
And yet, it's such a heartbreaking... The truth is so sad. The truth is so sad, and the fairy tale is so magical.
Mm.
The fairy tale is so glittering, and they both have to sit together in the same bracket.
Yeah,
they both feel the same. They're both two sides of the same coin. You know, it's this darkness and light,
and they both need each other to live
inside outside.
It's like, would we really think that much about Henry VIII if he didn't have six wives? Probably not.
How much do you think about Henry VII?
No, not at all. And it's like the crazy, tragic, odd, womany story of Henry VIII and the six wives is what we need to make the Tudor industry keep going. And similarly, the crazy flip of like the tragic sisters, the imposter, all this, they all need each other for the conversation to keep going, for these things to remain relevant or interesting to people, you know?
So many things happen involving men.
Yeah.
There are so many men in history that I think sometimes, particularly as like a little girl, you need to put your pin in being like, there's girls here.
There's girls here.
So I remember reading in an old New York Times article from just before the Anastasia cartoon came out. And it's furious. The article is really full of despair and angst about how inaccurate the cartoon is. And many people are furious. They're writing into the New York Times. Historians are being like...
People are still furious about it.
Are they?
Yeah.
Huh. Mm. There's so much to be mad about. I feel like you could be mad about...
So many
300 things before you were mad about that. But they are very mad. And they say, sure, this movie might introduce 100,000 little girls to Russian history. But 99,999 of them will forget it, and 1,000 of them will remember it, but remember it wrong.
Mm.
Something like that. And it's like, no, I think those 1,000 little girls went away, and I've just realised how wrong the maths was in that adding up. I don't
That's
care.
Fine. We all get the point.
So many of those 1,000 little girls went away and were like, now I care. Now yeah. I am interested in both this period of history and those big questions, because the movie is so charming, but it is also very dark. I mean, it doesn't shy away from the darkness of the story. It gives you a happy ending, but Rasputin is a very scary character.
It's like I admire the movie so much for judging perfectly how much children can take, the answer to which is more than you think, you know?
Always.
A little more than you think, you know? That I think to open on this, like, on the Russian royal family, on, like, this young girl, we see everybody there, we are very much told they're all dead and gone by now. Angela Lansbury, together in Paris, all this, and then having the Bolsheviks raise that palace and kind of give the sort of spooky, magical explanation that it's like, oh, it's because Rasputin's a wizard and he's bewitched them all and that's why the fall of the Tsars happened. That's, like, I can understand why a scholar of Russian history would be like, that's very offensive.
I mean, yeah, but what are you going to do? Be like, children, here's a lesson on feudal serfism.
No, exactly. I remember reading an interview with Don Bluth and he said, I drew the line at animating Karl Marx. I was like, that is a good line to draw. It's like, you have completely, effectively captured the drama and the fear and the sense of, like, a glamorous world like crumbling down, of lostness, of trauma. Like, I think if you watch that movie again as an adult and you see all these moments where she is, like, being bewitched by Rasputin and being, like, there's a point where they're on a boat and she is sleepwalking and almost, like, sleepwalks off the edge of the boat because she thinks she's going swimming with her family, and all of her family members are animated exactly how they are in photographs, and many parts of the movie are animated exactly as they were in photographs.
And there are photographs. In the photo frames, there are real photographs of the Romanov.
It's very spooky, like, how much care is taken. And you could really see that as an adult watcher, as, like, not a Rasputin being spooky and magical, but as a, this is how trauma manifests in people.
I think the movie does carry a huge sense of that trauma. I mean, not to dwell too much on that boat scene, but it's horrific. The boat is in a storm and two little bad bits of magic land on her sleeping chest as butterflies.
Mm.
And in her dreams, she follows the butterflies to where her dead family are all playing in a lake, calling to her to come to them.
Yeah.
And begging her to hurry up and come and play, and that they're all there and waiting for her. And in reality, she's walking off the edge of the ship.
Yeah.
As an adult, it is genuinely horrifying.
It's horrifying. And, like, especially when you think of, again, these stories are layers and layers of, like, you know, film cells on top of each other kind of thing. Of, like, in the 1997 movie, she's walking off the side of a ship. In the 1956 movie, she opens it trying to walk off a bridge. In the real Anna Anderson story, it begins with her being hospitalized because she tries to kill herself by drowning herself. Like, it's this thing of, like, this constant thing of, in every single iteration of the story, no matter how magical or mad or strays far from the truth, it's like, this is someone who cannot deal with the burden of what they've been asked to put up with and, like, needs to drown themselves. Like,
yeah. And this kind of, there's something quite symbolic, isn't there, about the kind of the water kind of overwhelming.
Yeah.
The kind of the waters closing over. There's so much stuff in classical mythology and stuff, like the waters of Lethe, like the water that makes you forget, the water that takes you away, the kind of the Styx in Greek mythology. There's always rivers taking you to death, and there's always kind of rivers and lakes and waters closing over your head to indicate both forgetting and trauma and memory loss and pain and death and the kind of ending of trauma and pain.
Mm.
There's some really big symbolism going on there for little kids,
and I loved it.
I also loved it, and I think that was not all about the clothes.
No, I mean, the clothes help, and the dog helps, and the bat helps,
the men's pajamas, the huge coat,
every outfit is incredible, even the kind of bad one of her in the blue dress, the belt around it. Then the romance is incredible. It's just so good. I think it's the perfect movie. The bangers. Rumour in St. Petersburg is the fucking best opener to any musical.
I would be inclined to agree. I think also it sets up this whole world.
Yeah.
Immediately of a society that runs on gossip and rumour.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is...
And we're here dealing with a gossip rumour, you know?
And, you know, we are here almost 30 years after the movie comes out being like, what of the rumours that were this movie are true rumours mm-hmm. and which are just lies based yeah. on another movie, which is must be a bit based on My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
It must be. You don't have that kind of like...
Which itself is a play based on... A film based on the play Pygmalion.
Which like, is a play based on a Greek myth.
Yeah.
And we are intrigued by these stories of transformation. It's Cinderella. It's all the other fairy stories as well. We are intrigued by stories of metamorphosis and transformation and things kind of coming back out of the dark.
Yeah. And I think also to make the Cinderella parallel again... It's this thing of someone who is helped by glamour, but it's really about who they are and what they know. And with Cinderella, it's like, she's decent, she's lovely, she's like the true sort of... The idea of like, the Princess and the Pea as well, it's like, oh, the true spirit of the princess within, the graceful, kind thing. Whereas with Anastasia, it's about all the things she knows that she has in her brain that you can't see and sometimes she can't even get at.
I tell you what, Cara, it's a little princess is what it is.
It's a little princess is what it is.
A little princess, a true princess would buy buns.
A true princess buys buns for
and
the poor
the
girl.
And the reward for that is that you... get the princess things.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like so much in the story that like it's so funny, like the eyewitness accounts at the time of Anna Anderson are like, she was so rude and haughty and felt herself to be above everyone that everyone thought, yes, she must be an aristocrat because she's so cunty to everybody.
But that's it again, isn't it? It's about the decorum and the bearing and the kind of...
Yeah.
It's inner outer.
Inner outer. In the family, out the family. What are your other favourite bits of the movie? Just because I'm conscious that this might be a little bit of a bummer. So I'm like, what are some fun bits of the movie?
Okay, I love the music box because I find the music box to be just like the perfect size trinket to think about.
Mm.
A music box is a perfect trinket. It's kind of like a locket, which, you know, is also relevant. Yeah. But a music box is a perfect trinket because it fits in your hand. Mm. It sings a song. And you can think about the song all the time and you can sing it in your head when you are frightened. Mm. And you can keep things in it, which is a perfect size treasure for a child.
Yes.
It's just very covetable.
And it's like also the thing of like it's almost a Fabergé egg, but it's not a Fabergé egg.
It's almost a Fabergé egg. I mean, I still think about Fabergé eggs all the time.
All the time. We couldn't get tickets to the V&A Fabergé egg.
So many other people were thinking about Fabergé eggs.
I know. I mean, I think if you need any proof that the Anastasia myth is alive and well in people's hearts and minds is that you could not get into that V&A fucking Fabergé egg exhibit.
It's because they're tiny. People love tiny things. I love tiny things. Mm. There is a complete delight in the miniature and the precious. And, you know, some of those Fabergé eggs, you know, the ones where it just lifts up and it's the whole palace is inside the egg.
Mm.
The whole palace is inside the golden egg. And I think also it's the sense of having a completely useless tiny object.
Yes.
Very nice.
Very nice.
And also with the music box, having a very tiny object, thing that serves no purpose except the great purpose of proving your true self.
Mmm. So good. And the whole thing, I mean, the whole sort of Dimitri as a boy rescuing her from the palace. And it's like, again, to go back to Don Bluth, realizing that how much kids can take is just more than you think. A young boy gets pistol whipped by a Bolshevik in the opening 5 minutes of that fucking movie. You don't see it, but he is fully butted with that rifle while Anastasia escapes through a hole in the door with her grandmother. Then doesn't get on the train and goes to a fucking orphanage.
I mean, I love when they're going back through the countryside and she is remembering things from her childhood.
Which is, when she's walking back through the palace, when she returns to the palace,
that
and like
to me is
blowing the dust off the plates and like hearing that tinkle going through the do 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 do, which is taken from an actual Russian ballet, which is so satisfying to me.
I think thinking back, this is probably where that image for me started.
Mm.
Is of just like, yes. A cloud of dust rises and I see the name yes. underneath, which is something I circle around in everything I write, is the sense of like, what if you blew the dust off something and it went And then he saw it.
Yeah, and then you saw yourself dancing with your father in the reflection of the plate. But then you turned your head. Which is, again, it's a really beautiful manifestation of like how memory works, is that like she picks up this plate, there's a glimpse of her dancing with her father in the reflection of the plate, but she's already moved on to something else. Like, that's such a beautiful artistic rendering of like how none of us are really in control of our own memories.
Of memory and ghosts.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it feels very relevant. And it feels particularly relevant to me to make this a Christmas episode, because this is a time of year where there are so many ghosts.
Yeah.
So many things you kind of...
Yeah.
Do at Christmas. So many traditions you're like, oh, we did this like that, or we're doing it differently now, or we used to do it like this with her, or this was how it used to be with him. And, you know, I think probably the best times are where you can kind of incorporate those ghosts into your life, and you can make them into you can make them into a tradition that is not stuck, but is instead alive and living.
Yeah.
And the worst ghosts are this kind of thing that I think so many people feel at this time of year, of being like, well, what is it if it's not that?
Is there anything else we want to say about Anastasia? Either the 1987, the 1956, Anna Anderson, the princess herself who died as a teenager, or anything between all of these conflicting myths, all of which I care about the same amount, which is a lot.
I think what I do want to say is that I don't know that I'd care about any one of these things without all of the others.
Very good.
It is very much for me.
You can't care about Catherine of Aragon without caring about Anne Boleyn, without caring about Jane Seymour.
You can't. All the women are tied up in one.
Yeah.
All these selves, all these alternative lives get tied up together. And you're going to like this one, but I'm going to bring it back to Christmas again.
Yay!
And I think that is what happens to you. It happens, I think, at most anniversaries or birthdays and Christmas. These significant points in your life where you get to look at all the different ways your life might have gone, and all the different people you used to be and all the people you still might be. Because it lets you check in, like, oh, wow, I used...
Yeah.
10 years ago, it was like this.
Yeah,
20 years
last
ago,
Christmas
like
we were doing this, and 10 Christmases ago we were doing this, and...
Which, of course...
Now there's a baby, and before there wasn't, and you know, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
You know?
And, of course, you can do that, like, at any time. But at Christmas, it's like, what were you doing on the 25th of December?
Mm.
What were you doing every year for your whole life, and what are you going to do for the rest of it? And I think it's that braid of identity that makes this so compelling, and it makes it, for me, an ultimate Christmas story. Because it's about identity, and it's about self, and it's about time. Time and memory and tradition. And you need all of those different Annas. You need all of those different Annas to make sense. To make sense of the self, to make sense of who we are and how we live.
All of the Annas. You're so right, because it is like... It's like 100-something years of this tradition of telling the story, and it changes every time. And it gets softer every time, you know?
Yeah, because all of the people involved are dead, and they would be dead even if they'd lived long and happy lives.
Yeah.
And the further away from it we get, the more that's true, the further we go into the future. I don't know, we did like a little toast with our Bucks Fizz to Anastasia, but it should have been to all the Annas.
To all the Annas.
To all the Annas.
I love them all.
I love them all too.
I love the cartoon. I love Ingrid Bergman. I love Franziska Jankowska. I love Anna Anderson. I love Anastasia Romanoff.
Yeah.
I love Anastasia the pop singer who wears those rose-coloured glasses. And who sang Left Outside Alone, which is in many ways the anthem of this myth. I hope all the Sentimental Garbage listeners, as this is the last episode of the year, have a Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year. And also, you know, maybe consider adopting a brand new identity in 2024. Like, what else are you doing? Ella, what are you doing? You've got the best Substack in the world.
I have. It's ella.substack.com, a name I got very early.
I can't believe you got ella.substack.com.
I was an early adopter, and then I just sat on it writing, like, occasional weird posts that I immediately deleted for years. And now it's a Substack that I do...
Like, professionally?
Professionally, yeah. like, twice a month, three times a month. At the moment, we're on a real streak of, like, twice a week because it's Christmas and people like to feel things at Christmas.
If you want more of Ella, but also more of this kind of spirit, I really recommend the recent Velvet essay, which is both a shopping guide and just nice
just some
thoughts on velvet and things related to
Thoughts on velvet? Who we become when we wear velvet? Can I personally wear more velvet?
Yeah, it's very in theme with this podcast, I think.
Great, yeah.
Is that, like, you think you're hearing about a cartoon or a piece of fabric, but actually you're hearing about the whole world and how it fits inside this thing, which I would think is your great skill and why I love talking to you and I love that you're my best friend.
I love being your best friend too.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas, best pal.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.